Great. Well, thank you everyone for coming to the meeting. And I just want to start out by saying thank you to my collaborators. It was a really great collaboration. They know lots of things that I knew nothing about and worked really hard on the project. Unfortunately, couldn't be here, but yeah, it was great. So I'm going to be speaking about constraints on physical computers in holographic spacetimes. So this is a project somewhere at the interface of complexity theory and quantum gravity. We've been hearing a little bit about that today, but I just want to start out by giving sort of very general, high-level comments about what complexity theory is and how it works. So in complexity theory, we start out by choosing some sort of a model of computation. And then within that model, we study the resources that we need to solve whatever problem that we're interested in. So we might, for instance, be thinking about Turing machines and then ask how many steps on my Turing machine does it take solve some problem. In the cases we care the most about, these models of computation are chosen to try and capture the power of actual physical devices. Okay. So a Turing machine is meant to capture the power of real physical computers that you can build, and similarly for quantum circuits and quantum physics. Something I want to emphasize here, though, is that the connection between these mathematical models of computation and the power of real physical devices is not a connection that complexity theory itself really addresses. It's basically an assumption somewhere underneath complexity theory, which we call the extended Church-Turing thesis or the quantum extended Church-Turing thesis, that roughly says that these things are, that these models actually efficiently capture power of these physical devices. Okay, so here, I'm framing that because I want to do something a little bit different. What I want to do is start out with just the laws of physics in some context, and then go from there to constraints on computation. I want to do that without putting in my hand some choice of a model. A little bit more specifically, the physical setting that I want to think about is the context of quantum gravity. Okay. And because that's sort of the broadest set of physics or arena that I can think about, really I'm trying to ask just what are the physical limits of computation? So we're trying to ask this sort of fundamental question. Okay. So I'm, of course, not the first person to think about this. Famously, Seth Lloyd, back in 2000, studied this from what we'll refer to here as sort of a bulk perspective. Okay, so he was thinking, directly about quantum gravitational physics and trying to put constraints on computation in that setting. Thinking about that, he came up with what's now called Lloyd's bound, which is this interesting constraint on how fast you can run a computer. Something that I want to briefly mention here is just that there is some sort of assumption about what kind of model you're thinking about here. So to justify Lloyd's bound, you should be thinking about a circuit model of computation. And in all cases, or at least in the case of gravitational physics, it's not clear to me that that's really a justified starting point. Or if you're thinking about it like the CFD, if you're thinking about the local Hamiltonian, you justify this and it's fine, and that's the context people in this field have used it. But if you want to address computation in the bulk, I think this, at least is not where I want to take as a. Okay, so instead of taking a sort of direct bulk perspective, we're going to make use of ADS CFT. We're going to ask this question about computation in the context of gravity by instead thinking about the conformal field theory and the boundary, where it's just a quantum mechanical system. And in particular, we're going to apply some sort of quantum information constraints at the level of the boundary to try and understand computation. Taking this approach, we're going to show something really, really basic and preliminary, but sort of the first non-trivial thing you could hope to show, which is just that for certain space-time regions, there exists algorithms that you cannot run inside of that. That's going to be today's talk. Okay. So Before I move on, I want to give a sort of second and, you know, it's full disclosure, more speculative motivation for thinking about this. Okay, so yeah, second, more speculative motivation for what I'm thinking about. Let me frame this in the following way. So let's think about some sort of a space-time that has a space-like singularity in it. So let's say the two-sided black hole. And we'll make just a trivial comment about this, which is just that if you're a bulk observer and you jump into the hole, you experience at least according to the general relativistic description here, you experience a finite amount of proper time. So time, there's some sort of space-like boundary to this manifold where time ends for you. On the other hand, in the CFT, time runs forever. There's no boundary, there's no like future boundary to this manifold. And you know, it's a classic question in quantum gravity to just try and understand how do you reconcile these two pictures. So this is just my way of saying, you know, how do we understand the appearance of the bulk singularity from the perspective of the CFT? And the sort of speculative comment thing I want to put forward is the following idea. So I want to argue that the CFT, or here the two CFTs, is going to place some kind of constraints on which computations can happen in the interior of the hole, and that the way that the bulk manifests those constraints on computation is by just chopping off the amount of time that you have to perform it, or to perform your computation. So said in this sort of contrapositive way, you know, if I threw a computer in and had an infinite amount of time that I could let it run, there would be no computational constraints on it, but I claim that, you know, in the CFT, we can place those constraints, and hence, you know, time had to come to some sort of an end. So today, you know, the way that this work today that fits into here is I'm just going to be talking about the first point. So I'm going to try and argue mostly at the level of the CFT that there are these computational constraints, but I'm not going to say anything further about, you know, whether I can really connect that to the appearance of the singularity. That's just a provocative statement that I wanted to put forward. Okay, and then a caveat is that I'm not going to give a fully CFT argument. I'm going to use some bulk physics, and then I'm going to, at some point that I'll hopefully make clear, make use of the covariant entropy bound in them. Good, okay, so let me start out by giving the tools from quantum information theory that we're gonna make use of. So the key notion that we're gonna use is the idea of what's called a quantum processor. Okay, the processors are almost just quantum computers, so let me sort of reframe what a computer is for a moment. So here's my computer. What is it? Well, it's a device that takes two inputs. Okay, one of the inputs I'll call X. It's the data that goes into the computer. And then the other input I'm calling P. It's the program that the computer is going to apply to the data. So in goes X and P, and out comes P acting on X. In the quantum setting, how would I describe this? Well, my computer is going to become some sort of a map. It's going to be an isometric map, and now it's from the A and P Hilbert spaces into the A and E Hilbert spaces, where E is allowed to be bigger than P. Okay. If this thing is working correctly, what it should do is T acting on an arbitrary input state psi to the A system, and what we'll call a program state on the P system should apply some specific unitary U acting on psi, and then leave the E system in some junk state. Okay, it can be whatever you want. And the unitary U is supposed to be specified by the state on the P Hilbert space. So that's why there's this phi with a subscript U on it. Okay. So it's just the same as the classical setting, except now there's cats. Okay. Okay. So that's basically a quantum computer. I refer to this as a quantum processor when we additionally are going to specify the dimensions of the A and P Hilbert spaces. So that's the really the only difference.
Okay. Good. So a interesting fact about these quantum processors is that they are subject to constraints that are somehow very universal. So those constraints don't depend on any of the details of the map T beyond just the dimensions of the A and P Hilbert spaces. So I want to write down for you one such constraint that we prove in this work. So we're going to consider a particular family of unitaries, which we're going to label the entries in that family U superscript epsilon. They're diagonal unitaries. They act on the A Hilbert space, so they're matrices of size 2 to the NA by 2 to the NA. And on the diagonal, I just have plus and minus signs. They're very simple. And then there's a constraint on how well any processor, T, can perform this family of unitaries. Okay, and this is the constraint here. Let me sort of break it down. So the object on the left is, I'll explain in more detail, but it's something about the average case performance of this quantum processor. Okay, so it says if I pick a epsilon, which is the string of signs on the diagonal, how well do I expect to do? And the upper bound on your average case performance looks like this. It's NP, the number of qubits in the P Hilbert space, divided by 2 to the NA, where NA is the number of qubits in the data space. Okay, so it's saying that unless the program is exponentially bigger than the data, you do really poorly. Okay. Okay, and then what is this measure of average case performance? I won't give you the full expression, but I've said it sort of in words on the right here. So this quantity, P T epsilon, is the, it should say squared overlap, the squared overlap of the correct output, so you know, U epsilon acting on the input state psi, overlapped with the actual output of the processor T. Okay. And when I look at that, I get to optimize over all the program states phi sub U. So I have this processor, I get to feed in the best possible program to the processor, and then I'm looking at basically the fidelity of its output with what it's supposed to be output. Good. So that's all the QI tools that we're gonna need. I should say there's a lot of work hidden behind that inequality. It looks really simple, but very interesting statement. Okay, so now we're gonna think about black holes and computers doing things inside of black holes. So here's our basic setting. We have our two-sided black hole. We're gonna try and implement one of these unitaries drawn from this family inside of the hole. Okay. The inputs to the computation we're gonna have fall in from one asymptotic region, so let's say the left. So there's some state psi. And then on the right, we're gonna have another system falling in, P, where P stores the program that I'm supposed to be applying. So it stores the record of which unitary I'm supposed to do. Okay. Another important point here is that additionally, all the other degrees of freedom I might make use of to apply this unitary, i.e. the physical device, the computer, is also gonna fall in from the right here. And it counts as part of the P degrees of freedom. Okay. Then we're gonna make a circuit model for what's happening here, or a circuit that captures what's happening here. So it looks like this thing on the right. The curve on the bottom is representing the entangled state of the left and right CFTs. And then we have some Hilbert space, which I've called capital A, storing the input. V left acts on the left CFT, and this sort of external A Hilbert space takes that quantum information, inserts it into the bulk. Once I've inserted into the bulk, I'm calling it the little a Hilbert space. And then on the right, I insert the p degrees of freedom into the bulk in the same way. Some time evolution happens on each side. That's absorbed into the VL and VR. And then at some late time, I act jointly on both CFTs to try and recover the outputs from this computation. And then what we're going to make use of is the observation that if indeed this computation can happen inside of the bulk, right? So if at some late time this U acting on psi appears in the bulk picture, then this recovery map should be able to extract it and say put it on the first wire of this circuit. we're going to study constraints on this circuit, and then in that way, understand constraints on what can happen inside the hole. Okay. One important comment here is that this circuit picture that I'm drawing, we know really only makes sense when the inputs that I throw in are not too large. Okay, so the fact that I chose a single fixed map R that is independent of the states that I'm putting in, psi and the state on P, means that I should take NA and NP to be smaller than the black hole entropy. Okay. I'm writing much less than to keep things simple in the context of this talk. There's a slightly more involved argument where you can just take this to be less than or equal to, and you should think of this as enforced by applying the covariant entropy bound to the black hole horizon. That's where I'm using that. Okay, good. So that's our setting, the setting that we're gonna try and constrain. A little bit more detailed, I'm gonna work in a somewhat more specific regime. So not only am I gonna take NA and NP to be smaller than the black hole, I'm also gonna take NA to be sort of sufficiently large, which is gonna mean bigger than log of S black hole. And that should make sense because I'm saying that I'm gonna construct some computation that's gonna be hard to do. If the inputs of the computation were arbitrarily small, it wouldn't make sense that it was impossible to do. Okay. Good, so then the first thing we're gonna do is recall our circuit, and we're gonna view this whole circuit, we're gonna forget a bunch of details for a moment, and we're gonna view it just as a single isometry T, and view it as one of these quantum processors, right? It's supposed to be applying these computations, and so it's a quantum processor. Okay, let's apply our processor constraint that we wrote down a few slides ago. We get this bound on the average case performance of the processor. If we look at the regime that we're in, we can see that this upper bound, NP over 2 to the NA, is always much less than 1. That's why I put in that lower bound. And so what is this, what is this saying? Well, it's saying that, on average, when I try and do these unitaries inside the hole, I will fail. Okay. So in other words, most of these unitaries cannot be implemented inside of the black hole. Now, that's a sort of first pass at a constraint, but I claim that it's just not an interesting constraint yet. And basically, the reason it's not interesting is because it should be understood as an information theoretic constraint and not the computational kind of constraint that we're aiming for. So let me explain why that is. So we have two facts. We have that what we've showed is that for a typical unitary in this family, it's forbidden from happening inside of the hole. Okay. But we also know something else about typical unitaries, right? So one of these unitaries, it's got 2 to the NA signs on the diagonal. If I want to fully specify it, right, I have to tell you 2 to the NA bits so that I can tell you whether each of those entries is plus or minus 1, right? And in the regime that I'm working, it happens to be true that 2 to the NA is bigger than S black hole. And so what it means is that the description of this unitary just doesn't fit inside the hole. Okay. And so of course I can't do it there. I can't even tell you what you're supposed to be doing. So that's what I mean by an information theoretic constraint. Okay, so to get around this, what we have to do is try and find a unitary that is both forbidden and also has a short description. Something where that string of epsilons is very compressible and can be specified in many fewer bits than 2 to the NA. So there is such a thing, and the construction is either really silly or really clever, depending on your mood. And what it is this. So we're gonna notice that these unitaries have a natural ordering. Okay, so I can interpret these plus and minus ones on the diagonal as just a binary number. That gives me an ordering. And then what I say is I define some special unitary U epsilon naught as the first unitary in this family that's forbidden. So where this success probability or this fidelity is small. Okay, so why does this work, right? Well, first of all, by construction, it is a forbidden unitary, right? That's in the definition. And then Well, I should also say it exists because we know that this PET is small on average, and so in particular there has to exist an element that's small. And then I just have to argue that this description is actually short and can be specified in you know, much smaller than S black hole bits. Okay. Now, it looks super short because I just wrote it on this slide, right? But it's, you know, it's not as good as that because there's these mathematical objects appearing there, and to fully specify the string, I have to tell you what all of those objects are. Okay. So the sort of dominant contribution to the descriptive length of this unitary turns out to come from specifying the map T that's inside of this P, okay? And that's where, you know, before we looked at this circuit and we just drew a box around it and forgot all of the details, to understand, you know, how to specify T and how to do so efficiently, that's where, you know, we actually have to do some work, and it turns out to require on the order of log S black hole bits. So it's still very small. That log S black hole should roughly make sense in that the whole situation we're talking about here is specified by specifying first of all the solution, i.e. the black hole solution. And basically what I have to tell you is, you know, which solution I'm talking about. So I have to tell you this number S black hole, and to tell you a number S black hole, it requires about log bits. That's where that log is coming from. Okay, so that's all the ingredients for the construction. I can put all the pieces together now. So what's happening? We have our two-sided black hole. We think about the case where we try to do this particular unitary U epsilon naught inside the hole. I throw the inputs in from the left. I throw this very short description of epsilon naught in from the right, along with whatever computer I would like to build in from the right. They can interact inside of the black hole, but by construction from our argument here, we see that, you know, no matter how I build this computer, it is impossible to implement this unitary. And there was no information theory constraint. The computer sitting inside the hole has all the ingredients it needs. It has its inputs. It knows what it's supposed to do, but it just, for whatever reason, can't do it. And that's what we call a computational constraint. So one comment here, just addressing questions that I've got about this, and I think I didn't fully appreciate till getting grilled over dinner about it recently, is there's a key point here, which is that we want to say something, you know, not just about any particular computer that we throw inside the hole, but rather about any possible computer that I could construct in the bulk, okay? And we get that in this argument by having the computer itself be part of the input to the processor T that I defined at the level of the boundary. If instead I thought about a computer sitting in the bulk and I applied the processor bound to it directly and then ran the same argument, I would instead construct a computation that that particular computer cannot do. But by taking this outside view, we get a universal constraint. Good. So that's the main point. I'll just like really briefly summarize. So it's a sort of subtle argument, so let me just say a very high-level view of it one more time. We have this computer sitting inside the black hole, and there's two views. There's a bulk view and the boundary view. From the bulk view, it appears that I've built this universal computer that, if I let it run forever, would be able to run, you know, any computation. In the boundary, I view this whole situation in terms of a quantum processor, and there are these constraints, okay? And then the whole rigmarole I went through of constructing this compressed string and so on amounts to showing that information theoretic constraints don't suffice, and instead computational constraints are necessary to resolve this tension between the bulk and boundary perspectives. There's lots of interesting questions here, I think. The argument itself doesn't say anything about what the constraints on the bulk are that are imposing this, you know, this limit on computation. And then, you know, you could bring this back to what I was speculating about before, that it has to do with the appearance of the singularity and the end to time there.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask a question first.
Taking those privileges.
I guess I would like to know to what extent this constrains just classical computation. And I guess also I'm curious if instead of the computation model you're using, I think of one where I run a calculation and get like a numerical answer at the end. Does this constrain like the first interesting program of this type too, or was it really important that it was a unitary?
Yeah, so I don't really know. I mean, basically what you would have to do to address those questions is reprove the processor bound for other sets of unitaries, or sorry, other computations, maybe a classical one. I don't know how to do that. I don't have a strong expectation as to like when they exist and when they don't. So
what ingredients go into the processor bound?
Functional analysis and Banach space theory.
All right.
Yeah, things I know very little about, but just enough about.
I was wondering if you could explain one more time why does this description complexity is logarithmic in the black hole entropy? Because I would have naively thought that you would have to specify the circuit for this unitary, which seems to be at least like linear in the
so
entropy.
So you don't have to specify the circuit. You have to specify a way of constructing the circuit. Okay. And then that's much shorter.
I see.
Your main result got a bit good as me here.
Sorry. lights.
So your main result got a bit goodly for me. So
a bit what, sorry?
Goodly. Kurt Gödel.
Okay.
So it's a short description that I can that makes sense.
Yeah.
But somewhere the P system that you threw in must be constructing a gate based on the short description. Could it be that constructing the gate takes constructing the full quantum circuit takes so many gates that like you just collapse into a singularity?
So I mean, okay, let me say two things. So the first is that I wasn't super careful here, but it's really not applying this unitary that is the hard problem that I'm showing is impossible. It's, you know, starting from the compressed description, then go and apply the unitary, right? The inputs are the compressed description plus the quantum thing. And it, you know, we think it's much harder to decompress this description than it is just to apply the unitary on its own once you have the description. So that, yeah, the bulk of the complexity I think is coming from there. What the mechanism is in the bulk that is preventing you from doing this, I don't know. This construction itself doesn't say anything, but I think there's an interesting discussion there to be had. So maybe I'll just leave that open.
Maybe if I can just re-ask the question, maybe. I guess this you have proved as a short description, so this is Kolmogorov complexity in the classical case.
Yeah.
But then there's actually complexity of computation. Have you proved that is small or not? So I guess
the complexity of running this unitary?
Yeah, unitary given the description.
Yeah, so we think that's actually very high complexity.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, somehow the fact that this is forbidden is probably related to the fact that it's a very high complexity computation that we constructed, though, I should emphasize that the argument itself is not using that this computation is high complexity.
Last thing, sorry. So could there possibly be an easy to decompress unitary that cannot be done?
I would expect no, because I would think that you could do low complexity things in the interior, but this argument doesn't directly bear on that question.
Yep.
Sorry. Where exactly enters the existence of a black hole in your
good thing? Good question.
Why, because you can do it without the black hole, and it's the same, right? So that's what I don't understand.
Yeah, good. Okay, so I think the way to think about this is that I chose to study black holes from the beginning, and it's not really necessary to have done that. So there's some version of this that you can think about in global ADS and things like that. Okay, but where does data about the black hole like enter into this construction? It's really okay, so there's this circuit. Part of specifying this circuit is, in part you have to specify that state that I feed into it. That state on the two CFTs is this black hole state. And so some sort of data about the black hole enters the construction from there.
So you cannot do the same in pure ADS?
You can do the same in pure ADS, but now you're going to be dealing with a different set of parameters. So the descriptive complexity is not going to be related. Like here, the descriptive complexity was log S black hole. In pure ADS, there's various things that you could think about. You could think about, say, letting the computation run for some amount of time, like boundary time t. Now the descriptive complexity looks like log of that t. And you construct some other computation that you can't do there. And then the computation you can't do there will turn out to have a complexity that's like large as a function of that parameter t. So it says that in some amount of time t, you can't do something with complexity much, much larger than t. Gives you some reasonable thing.
Maybe one last question.
So you made the comment of if we applied the bound in the bulk, we would get a restriction on a specific computer, whereas by taking the bound on the boundary, you get rid of this specificity. Could you clarify that?
Oh, okay. So this has to do with what I said earlier, that so there's this processor applied at the level of the boundary. I'm thinking about this processor where into one input, I feed the data that I want to act on. And then into the other input, I feed a description of the program I want to apply, plus a description of the computer that I'm inserting in. Okay, and then I find a constraint that applies to like just that processor. And the constraint itself doesn't know about which input I chose. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's some supremum over the input I chose. I don't know if that helps. So basically, in that way, you get rid of the dependence. Like, if you apply this processor constraint to the computer in the bulk, then the map T itself is defined by the description of that computer. Whereas here, the map T is just defined by the choice of state and the bulk to boundary dictionary.
I think. Thanks.
All right, I think that's it. There's a virtual poster session starting at 5:30. Yep. I think they're not feeding anyone, but maybe there's virtual food.